The Service of Our Love by Morbith, read by Cookie Mom 6067. Chapter 1. Are we doing this? Are we really doing this? He remembers leaning his head against Yusuf's shoulder, watching the waves gently crash against the shore. We could do some good. True, Yusuf's chest rising as he breathed in deeply. But it will be dangerous. We could die. Or you could get hurt. We could get hurt. That's different. I don't care if it's me. But I can't stand to see you hurt, Nico. I never could. If something happened to you, I couldn't live without you. Some would call it an exaggeration or melodramatic or a red flag. Their therapist called it a sign of codependency. But for them, it's simply the truth. Neither could I. He had been too scared to look at him, so he kept his eyes on the rolling sea, on the moon that shone above it. It scares me sometimes, what I do for you, how far I'd go. He remembers thinking that Yusuf was his anchor, his life, and if there really was something wrong with him for feeling so, he never wanted to fix it. The church door opens, forcibly dragging him away from his memories, or perhaps he dozed a little. The past days have been difficult. He stands as Quinn comes in, smiling and full of energy. She throws her arms around his neck and kisses him on both cheeks. Nikki, where's Joe? He gives himself a moment to bask in her hug. He just left to get groceries. Didn't you see him? She shakes her head. He must have gone around the back. You look tired. An impish grin. Have you been fooling around? Nobody says fooling around anymore. She tosses her hair over her shoulder. I do, and I'm clearly not nobody. Nikki can't manage a laugh, but he smiles. Give me your bag. What's Andy's ETA? An hour and a half, probably less. You know how she is. That I do. He distracts her by asking about their time in Marrakesh, and how much the city has changed since they last were there, long before he or Joe were born. It's lucky the new immortal emerged while they were between jobs. 15 minutes later, Booker steps through the door. Ciao, Nikki. He crushes him in a hug, too, and ruffles his hair as though he were still a kid. Joe? At the supermarket. It will take a while. Are you planning a welcome feast? His smile dims a little, and he doesn't leave him time to answer. Have you been sleeping? You look... He trails off, uncharacteristically unsure. Nikki shrugs. Not very well. It will pass. It's nothing. Hey. Booker's hand catches him by the shoulder. You know you've nothing to worry about from the new one, or... He trails off again, though Nikki knows what he wants to ask. Well, not wants, really, but feels he must. He's wondering whether this is the proverbial last straw, if Nikki and Joe are starting to resent them and their immortality, if this is where they grow to envy and hate them, as if they didn't owe everything to him, Quinn, and Andy, as if they hadn't been family for 26 years. But it's a painful thought now, so Nikki pushes it away and forces himself to smile. We know, Uncle. We aren't worried about her. This he can say with absolute truthfulness. Andy's on her way. She should be here soon. I know. Quinn texted me when they landed. There's still some time. Why don't you go and take a nap? I'll wake you up before they arrive. Nikki shakes his head. No thanks. I'll sleep when Joe comes back. A bit too close to the truth, that. Quinn comes in right then, back from the bell tower. Hey, Booker. Hi, Quinn. News from Andy? What did she say about the new one? The new one stabbed her. She sounds proud already. She said, and I quote, that she thinks she has potential. Nikki lets out a low whistle. This is good, very good. Wow, that's really impressive. How? Booker shakes his head and turns to grab his bag. Let me put it this way, then. Nikki grabs it first. I got it. Don't worry about it. Thanks, Nikki. He moves to the table with Quinn, frowning. She is a Marine, which probably means trouble. And there's her family to consider, too. Quinn nods. Do you want to talk to her, or would you rather leave it to me and Andromache? Nikki lets them talk, puttering about in the kitchen. He's checking his phone too often, he knows he is. But Booker and Quinn are too busy to notice. Finally, Andy and the new one, Niall, Freeman, arrive. Nikki hangs back during the round of introductions, watching them. Niall looks tired and still a bit shell-shocked. It's still his best bet. Booker unexpectedly gives him the opening he needs. Joe isn't here, but he'll be back soon, right, Nikki? Nikki wets his lips. Speaking of Joe, I've got something to show you. He pushes his phone in Andy's hands, Booker and Quinn immediately moving next to her. Niall stays a little to the side, a look of polite interest on her face. What is it? Quinn teases him, smiling. Another poem? Then the video starts playing. What the? Booker, you were run over by a car? Port Elizabeth in March, Booker whispers, swallowing hard. Merd. Nikki has to hand it to Copley. His equipment was first rate. Even at night, the footage is incredibly clear. Booker's bones resetting, his pupils returning to normal size, even his first breath. It's all captured in perfect detail. I know your friend's secret, Copley's voice announces, cold and flat, as the video transitions to pictures. Andy, in the American Civil War. Quinn, in Vienna, at the turn of the last century. Andy and Quinn, in the French Resistance, in Vietnam, at the fall of the Berlin Wall. There's no use denying it. They are immortal, but he isn't. Joe, tied to a chair, his mouth taped shut, glaring furiously at the camera as he blinks and blinks. If you want him to stay alive, you'll do exactly as I tell you. We'll be in touch. Nikki, Andy begins to say, lowering his phone, but he can't let her go any further, can't give her more time. He's already got his USB compact in hand. I'm sorry. He pulls the trigger. Two shots in the head, and Andy goes down, then Quinn half-turned towards him, then Booker. He hates that Booker has to be the last, but it can't be helped. He knew he would be the slowest to react to his betrayal. Niall Freeman is not slow at all. She rushes at him, tries to disarm him, but she's only a Marine, and he was trained by Andromache the Scythian and Quinn of the Red River Valley. More than that, their lives are on the line, and he doesn't have time to waste. One arm and both legs broken, a bullet to the stomach, and she goes down. She grits her teeth, glaring up at him. What the fuck are you doing? Oh, she is promising indeed. He wishes he and Joe could get to know her. Whatever it takes. Chapter 2. Sebastian wakes up slowly, his head throbbing from a combination of repeated deaths and drugs, a very particular mix they developed to stay down longer as medicine and science advanced and faking their deaths became harder. It got them all out of serious trouble at least once, but right now he wishes he and Quinn had never come up with it. He's in the back of a van, his arms and legs wrapped in multiple zip ties and duct tapes. His limbs feel heavy, awkward, but he tries to break through them or slip a hand out unsuccessfully. Andromache and Quinn are lying next to him, fighting their own personal battles against the fog and ice enveloping their minds. Any moment now, and they'd realize where they are, what's happening. Who did this to them? Sebastian looks away. Even though he's lying down on metal, shaking and rolling with the van, he feels a black chasm, a dark abyss open beneath him, reach for him, and he teeters on the edge. Again, again, it happened again. Betrayed again, except the last time it wasn't a betrayal. It wasn't. Of course it wasn't. It was his fault. His fault. His fault. Not theirs. Never theirs. And this time. But this time. Maybe it's the thought of his biological sons. Maybe it's his heart breaking for Joe, for the Nikki he thought he knew, for Andy and Quinn caught in this nightmare with him. Maybe it's all of it, and it's a spark, an explosion, a fire roaring to life, burning through despair and pain. Anger is good. Anger keeps you alive. Maledetto bastardo! At least their mouths are still free. You selfish piece of shit! Leave it, Buck. Andy sounds tired, exhausted. She sounds like she's feeling every single one of her 6,000 years. Usually he wouldn't dream of disobeying her, but right now he's too angry, too incandescently furious. He kicks out against the side of the van, yelling more curses and obscenities, switching from French to Italian to Arabic and back again. Their languages, and they all feel like acid on his tongue. You're the worthy son of your mother! Enough, Quinn growls, and there's no disobeying that tone of voice. He grits his teeth. How are you not angry? It's not the first time somebody we cared about turned on us. Remember Berlin, 89? Lotso 6? Quinn replies. Panama, 51? Andy offers without opening her eyes. All right, we're not infallible, but we're usually better judges of character. He pointedly raises his voice on the last half of the sentence. Andy sighs, squeezes her eyes tighter. I can see why he'd do it, she says in a whisper. Me too. Quinn rolls on her side to be close to her. Booker can't believe his ears. What? Are you seriously? Andy's eyes fly open, fix him with an angry glare. You don't know what it was like when I lost Quinn, Booker. You weren't there. There's nothing I wouldn't have done to save her. Including selling out your own family. Andromache takes a deep breath. I'm not saying I approve of what he has done. There were 100 things he could have done differently. All I'm saying is that I understand it. Nikki and Joe are mortal, Quinn insists. It's different for them. Do not use that as an excuse. We raised them. And we told them to do anything to stay alive, remember? Anything at all, and we'd understand and forgive them. That's what we told them. I can't fucking believe it, not from you, Booker shouts at her. We have always been there for them, haven't we told them? Hell, haven't we proved it over and over? We'll live through this, like we have a choice. When I get my hands on him, you'll what? Quinn challenges him. Kill him? Kill Joe so Nikki will suffer? Kill them both? He falls silent. She's got him there and he doesn't like it. Not even a little bit. As furious as he is, they were their boys. If Nikki were in front of him right now, if he were free, he doesn't know what he'd do. Punch him, yes, but not as hard as he could. And after that, he'd walk away from both of them and never see them again. He should have trusted us, he mutters at last. He should have, Quinn agrees gently, and it only makes him angrier. Did he think we would have abandoned him and Joe? That we wouldn't have helped? That we wouldn't? He trails off, because he would have given his life, all his lives, for Joe, for Nikki. He's fairly certain Andy and Quinn would have done the same too, but he won't speak for them. The van keeps rattling along. Andromache and Quinn shift a little, trying to get some blood back in their hands without success. Niccolo knows them too well. The silence lasts a long time. It's hard to tell how long. They can't really see outside, but the light is changing, dimming. Finally, he can't keep silent any longer. I'm sorry, he chokes out. This is all my fault. Because of the car? Quinn says softly. You didn't know, Booker. How could you have known? He shakes his head, staring at the metal roof without really seeing it. Not for that, for not letting them go when we could. We should have taken them to a hospital like you wanted, or called the police after I killed Baker. If they had, Joe would have never been abducted again. Nikki would have never been forced to choose. No, Booker, Andromache says unexpectedly, you were right. We couldn't leave them in that house 1 second longer. It wasn't your fault they were already sick or that they got worse. But it was his fault that they ended up caring for them themselves. His fault because he panicked. because even more than 100 years after Jean-Pierre, he couldn't trust hospitals. Worst of all, some part of him can't regret it. He can still see them, even without closing his eyes. Joe and Nikki in that damp cellar. Joe and Nikki staring up at them with glassy eyes, coughing and burning with fever, their tiny hands reaching for them, raspy voices begging them not to leave them. So small, so fragile they looked. By the time they got better, it was too late. He'd grown attached. They all had. We all voted on it, remember? Quinn's voice again, but he can't look at her. We all decided. We knew the risks, even this one. I thought it would be different this time. He will not cry, not now. I thought, since they always knew, I thought, we all did, Basti. I should have known better. He knows what their gift does to normal people. He has seen it. And of course it's easy for a child to promise he'll always love his guardians. Easy for a teenager, a young man, who still feels invincible to say he'll never resent their eternal youth. We're older than you, and we didn't. If you want to blame somebody, blame us. He shakes his head. He was the one who had doubts, who'd been afraid, but the final decision had been his own. Silence again. The van travels on. Andromache's voice is quiet, yet it startles him anyway. Booker, remember the video Nikki showed us of your hit and run?
Yes.
Now, you know I'm no expert on technology. Twin snorts from him and Quinn because they both know the truth. But it looked very clear, detailed, the way it followed you and the boys, too, from the street to that alley.
It must have been a drone, Andy, he says tiredly. You've seen them. I don't know how much they cost, but they're not difficult to find.
But the camera, she insists. Don't tell me it was a normal one. Not with that clarity.
Definition, he corrects distractedly, his mind already at work. You're right, that would have cost a pretty penny. So?
So whoever has got Joe knows who we are, what we can do. Why are we being transported in a van like this? Why not an armored van? Why aren't there any guards?
Booker tries to shrug and huffs when he can't. We don't exactly need guards now. Nikki trussed us up like geese. He's probably taking us to the exchange point.
But why would they trust him to do it? She insists. Why not just kill us, call them, and hand us over?
I don't know, Andy.
What are you getting at, my love? Quinn asks, frowning.
Andy sighs. I don't know, not yet. I have a bad feeling about this.
Booker wants to tell her their predicament can hardly get worse than this, but closes his mouth without a word. He really doesn't want to tempt fate.
Quinn sighs. At least he let Nile go. It's something.
Trust her to say what had been in the back of everybody's mind.
I hope you're not counting on her to save us, Booker says. She still has a family out there. She barely met us, and well, we're not exactly safe right now.
Andy, though she spent the most time with Niall, offers neither comments nor insights.
Can you roll on your stomach, love? She says instead. Let's start with getting the duct tape off.
It's hard to tell how long it takes. A couple of hours, maybe more, biting and spitting and cursing, especially after night falls and they have to work blind. Eventually they are free, pins and needles vanishing from their arms and legs in a matter of seconds.
What now? Booker asks. This feels like a secondary road. We could jump out.
Andromache shakes her head. I want to see who's behind this. They lie in wait until the van finally rolls to a stop. The engine is turned off. The driver's door opens and shuts. They move to the doors quietly, wait for the moment they are unlocked, and start opening. Andromache kicks them open all the way, catching whoever is on the other side in the face and knocking them down. Except it's not Nikki, or some unknown thug. It's Niall Freeman, looking up at them with a bloody nose. There are a couple of bags on the ground next to her, Booker's and Quinn and Andy's, and absolutely nobody else.
Ow, fuck!
She spits out a couple of teeth. They stare at her, all of them, even Andromache.
Nile?
Where are we? Where are Nikki and Joe?
Looks like Val d'Argent, Quinn mutters. The abandoned mine we found during the Bosinc Wars isn't far. We last came here when...
When they brought Nikki and Joe camping in 1998, she doesn't say. They all know, anyway.
Andromache steps forward, grabs Nile by the neck of her shirt, and lifts her up.
What the fuck is going on? How do you know of this place?
I didn't, Nile gasps, raising her hands in surrender.
Nikki gave me a bunch of maps, told me to pick one and follow the road he'd marked.
And you just did? Andy frowns.
What about Joe and the video we saw?
He was very convincing.
Nile winces, either at the look on their faces or from feeling her teeth regrow.
I have his phone here. He said he left you a message that explains everything.
Andromache lets her go. Nile steps back, grabs a phone from her pocket, and holds it out to them. Both Andy and Quinn stare at it as though she were offering them a live grenade. Booker huffs, grabs it, and turns it back on. It feels like an eternity passes before he can finally put in the password, Joe's birth date, as usual. There's not much on this phone. The video they saw, and two others, presumably proof of life, and a single audio file. He presses play, and they all tense at Nikki's voice.
The man you heard in the video was James Copley.
Yes, that James Copley. 7 months spent dodging his calls. They all laughed when Joe wondered out loud whether the former CIA agent had gone into telemarketing rather than freelancing. It doesn't seem funny anymore.
He's probably the one who found out, and he's not working alone. He's backed by Merrick Pharmaceuticals. I know you don't trust me much right now, but I had it from Joe himself. It's in the first video I had them send me as proof of life.
Joe's blinking. It wasn't because of the lights or because he was fighting back tears. It was their own modified version of Morse code. One of the first things the boys learned when they were children. They thought it was the greatest thing ever, a secret code of their own. It had kept them occupied for days, weeks, sending messages back and forth.
You must be very careful. Joe and I will get Copley, hopefully, but Merrick, we have no way of getting to him, and you won't be safe until he's dealt with.
You, not we. Belatedly, he realizes that Nikki is speaking English, not one of their preferred languages. For Nile, most likely.
I'm sorry about shooting you and hurting you. I hope I didn't actually kill any of you. Si mancherebbe solo questa. I know you promised you'd always come for us, but...
He takes a deep breath.
Joe and I knew this could happen. We talked about it years ago, before we joined you, and we agreed, we both did. With Copley knowing about your gift, we don't want you within 100 kilometers of him or Merrick. It's too dangerous.
Out of the corner of his eye, he sees Andy and Quinn move closer together, their hands reaching for each other and holding on, as if they expect the sea to rise up and pull them apart again.
We promised to be your shield, and we meant it. We'll keep that promise, whatever it takes.
There's something in Nikki's voice that sends shivers down his spine. He wants to pause the message, but he can't. He can't. Nikki's still talking, and he needs to listen. He needs to hear his voice, even if it's just a recording.
Everything we have, everything we are, we owe it to you. Though it's not gratitude that moves us or duty. Please don't think it was just that. I won't tell you not to be sad for us, but we both want you to know this. We were on borrowed time, and we always knew it. That we got to spend it with you has been a privilege and an honor.
He doesn't like the way he sounds, like he's saying goodbye. He can't be saying goodbye, not like this. Not their Nikki. Not their Joe.
You told us we could choose how to end it if things went bad. This is our choice.
A soft breath.
Vi vogliamo bene. Stay safe.
The recording stops. Andromache breathes out long and deep like the air escaping from perforated lungs. Quinn isn't holding her hand anymore. She has her arms around her and her face pressed against her shoulder. He looks away from them, looks straight at Niall.
When do we contact them?
She frowns. Who?
Nikki and Joe. There's no SIM card here. He must have kept it. If he made you pick one of our bases at random, they won't know where to meet us. How long are we supposed to wait?
Niall stares at him, her eyes wide. I don't know. He didn't tell me. She swallows hard.
Booker, I had the radio on, and I guess you couldn't hear it in the back, and my French is not great, but I checked the news, the international sites.
She swallows hard again, wraps her arms around her body.
There was an explosion in Goosenville about an hour ago. The church.
He stares at her silently, uncomprehendingly. It's English, never one of his favorite languages at the best of times, but it doesn't make sense.
None of it does. So that's what he was really planning. The real trap.
It hadn't been for them.
Of course it hadn't been for them. How could he have thought that?
What was their exit strategy, did he tell you?
No, he didn't.
Booker. She casts a pleading glance to Andromache, but she has her arms full with Quinn, literally. His patience is wearing thin. He thrusts Nikki's phone back at her and starts patting his own pockets.
Our phones. Where are our phones? Did he keep them?
Niall fumbles with Nikki's phone, but doesn't drop it, clutching it close.
In your bags? I'm not sure.
He doesn't let her finish, dropping on his knees next to his bag and going through it quickly. His phone is turned off, too, and he knows Nikki had to do it, but wishes he hadn't. Technology. So fancy and always so unbearably slow.
He almost sees Andy's point. At least with carrier pigeons or messengers, you knew what you were getting into.
More waiting until the damn thing finally finds reception. Barely there, but it will be enough. It better be enough. He knows Nikki's number by heart. He knows all their numbers by heart. Even the backup numbers, just in case. The phone doesn't even ring. He gets the automated message right away.
La personne que vous essayez de joindre n'est pas disponible. Veuillez réessayer plus tard.
He hangs up, calls his first backup number.
La personne que vous essayez de joindre n'est pas disponible. Veuillez.
He hangs up, calls the first number again.
La personne que vous essayez de joindre n'est pas disponible.
Hang up. Dial Joe's number.
La personne que vous essayez de joindre n'est pas disponible.
He hangs up with a curse.
Fucking idiot. Copley had Joe's phone. They wouldn't have bothered to get it back.
Joe's first backup number then.
La personne que vous essayez de joindre n'est pas disponible. Veuillez réessayer plus tard.
Joe's second backup number. Nikki's second backup. Joe's first. Nikki's first. Again.
La personne que vous essayez de joindre n'est pas disponible. La personne que vous essayez de joindre. La personne que vous. La personne que vous.
His hands are shaking. He's breathing in short gasps, as if he had run all the way from Goosenville. He starts dialing another number. The boy's voicemail, the one that's always active. They'll check it eventually, they won't forget. And stops halfway through. He can't remember the last three numbers. How can he not remember the last three numbers? But the voicemail is for other people, for those who are not family, in case they need to leave a way to be contacted. He always has their numbers, all their numbers.
Andy, he says,
and his voice comes out choke, rasping.
Andy, you remember the boy's voicemail? Does it end in 641, or was it 416?
Booker, they aren't going to check their voicemail.
He scoffs. Of course they will. They're not you. They always remember.
Glued to their phones, especially when they're apart. Typical millennials.
Do you remember or not?
He tries Nikki's number again.
Booker.
Joe's backup number.
Booker.
Nikki's.
Sebastian. He looks up. Quinn is crying against Andy's shoulder, big tears sliding down her cheeks. But that's all right. She cries sometimes. It's Andromache who never cries. Andromache who... She has tears in her eyes. Andromache has tears in her eyes. The last time it happened was when Joe was shot, Somalia, 2013, or when Nikki almost drowned, Arissa, 2009. But she blinked them away in a second in favor of shouting at them. They are still there now. They don't fall, but they don't just disappear either. The phone slips from his hands. He hears it clatter on the ground. No. No, not the boys. They couldn't. Why would they? No, they can't have done it. They can't. Nikki loves Joe too much. He could never hurt him. Not for us, he wants to say. But the words stick in his throat. Nikki can be ruthless when his family is threatened. The Sao Paulo job, 2014. And so can Joe, South Sudan, 2011. Not cruel. They haven't got a cruel bone in their whole bodies, just ruthless. He wouldn't. They wouldn't. They have so much to live for. They wouldn't. Not our boys. No. He doesn't remember falling to his knees or switching back to French. He doesn't know when he started shouting. He doesn't see Quinn and Andromache stumbling towards him, doesn't hear their steps or their knees hit the ground. The first thing he knows is a pair of arms wrapping around him, then another, the wrong arms. Wrong, wrong, wrong. And his first impulse is to lash out, push them away, but it fizzles out and dies like a badly struck match. He wraps his arms around their shoulders and clings to them. His sisters, his family, the only safety, the only rock in the maelstrom raging around them, the only ones who understand. I called him a bastard. He whimpers against Quinn's hair. I cursed him. I said he was his mother's son. He didn't hear you, Basti, she whispers, hugging him tighter. He never knew. I never told them how much I love them. They knew that. Did they? All their lives, they were the boys, I ragazzi, Eluad, les petites, at best, mes poulets. He never called them mes fils. He had refused to be put down as Nikki's father, even if it would have made things easier, claiming it wouldn't have been fair to Yusuf, who remembered his real parents and whose grief they hadn't wanted to erase. He'd been so afraid of betraying Jacques, Henri, Jean-Pierre, as if they could have known. And because of that, Nikki and Joe died without knowing. Perhaps they died because they didn't know. It's too much, too painful a thought, and he crushes it, stomps it down, but he can't erase it, and it will come back to haunt him. He doesn't know how long they stay there. He doesn't know who moves first, if it's Andy or Quinn who guides Niall to the abandoned mine. He doesn't remember walking inside or who lit the fire. Everything hurts, even breathing, especially breathing. Anger was easier. Perhaps it will come back. He thinks about the name Nikki and Joe gave them, Merrick, Merrick Pharmaceuticals, and his hands clench in his lap. His laptop is in his bag, fully charged and entirely useless as long as they stay here. There's nothing he can do. Just sit here and wait and think. Yet another downside of their so-called gift. They have all been blown up or crushed, so they can't even tell themselves that the boys didn't suffer. They can only hope it was not for long, and at least it was only once. He should try and talk to the new one, to Niall. Joe and Nikki would expect it of him. They weren't with him when he first dreamt her. He told them over the phone. They had been surprised, like they all were, but happy, so happy for them, that their family would grow once more.
The last time he called them before starting for Goosenville, they had both been impatient to meet her. He realizes now it's the last time he ever spoke to Joe. 3 days ago. He doesn't feel like talking. The only words he says are to volunteer to keep watch, and it's rather more a statement of fact than an offer. As the others sleep or pretend to, he sits by the entrance and watches the road, or walks the perimeter silent as a shadow. No one comes for them. He doesn't know whether to be proud, his boys are good, his boys are thorough, or disappointed. In the morning, Andromache sends him to lie down farther away from the door where the light will not disturb him. Sleep eludes him, or perhaps he's fighting every step of the way like Jacques used to when he was a baby. Everything still hurts. There's still too many memories spinning around in his head. The day he found them. The decision of staying with them. The years raising them, training them. And through all that, the absolute trust in the boys' eyes when they looked at them. They weren't sure what they had done to earn it. All fully expected it would disappear one day. But though they had grown up, though they didn't always agree, though they saw them make mistakes and fail too, it had never vanished completely. They had trusted the boys with their lives, their secrets. Perhaps he ought to have had more faith in them. Eventually, exhaustion catches up with him. When he wakes up, he suddenly remembers 614. The last three digits of the boy's voicemail number were 614. He curls up on his side and cries silently, so Andromache and Quinn won't hear. Chapter 3. It scares me sometimes what I do for you, how far I'd go for you and our family. Yusuf nodded, his cheek brushing against his hair. I know, me too. It was a warm night, yet he felt him shiver. I'm so afraid for them. If they got caught now, it could be worse than being burnt at the stake, or an iron maiden at the bottom of the sea. So much worse. Both had had nightmares about military facilities or sterile laboratories. That's why we must do it. We'll keep them safe, like they did for us. Yusuf laughed then, the greatest sound in the world, especially when he could both hear it and feel it. I don't think they'd agree about that. We are only mortals, that's true. But that doesn't mean we can't be useful, although... He should have raised his head then, looked at Yusuf in the eyes, but he couldn't find the courage to do it. So he stared out at the sea as he asked the fatal question. Somebody could try and use us against them. What will we do then? A sharp intake of breath. He didn't explain that he hadn't meant in a normal mission-related hostage situation. He didn't need to. Yusuf always knows what he truly means. Selfishly speaking, I hope this hypothetical somebody gets us both. But if it doesn't happen, a long pause. We can't choose us, Nico. We just can't. If you can't do it, tell me now. And we'll drop the whole idea. We'll go back home. Next year, you'll start university, and eventually Booker, Andy, and Quinn will go their own way. He tried to imagine it. Their white picket fence life, he honestly did. Booker would like that. But you would not, would you? I wouldn't. Not now, at least. Not while we can actually do something. What about the other thing? Can you do it? He didn't answer right away. In the deepest reach of his heart, he already knew, but out of respect for Yusuf, for their family, he gave himself time to consider everything once more. In all other things, he always chose Yusuf. As much as he loved his family, he had been ready and willing to walk away without a backward glance if they had truly disapproved of their love, if they had tried to come between them. But they hadn't. Even Booker had come around much faster than they hoped. Perhaps he should have felt more conflicted, more scared, but in the end, the answer was obvious. Not easy, never that, just obvious. Yusuf is the love of his life. But that love has only been possible because of them. Because Booker found them. Because he and Andromache and Quinn saved them, took care of them, trusted them. Because Booker, Andy, and Quinn loved them first. How could they renege on that love, that care? Once he told them they were a miracle. But it had been during his religious phase, so they hadn't understood what he meant, and he had been too young to explain it properly. It hadn't been a good comparison anyway. They are much more than that, so much more. They are their mothers and father, their safe haven, their true home. For all that Booker, Andromache, and Quinn tried their best not to deprive them of their roots, the three of them are the only motherland they recognize, the only country to which they owe their allegiance. Yusuf is his entire world. But what are they compared to the world? Compared to centuries, millennia spent saving lives, two drops in the ocean, the blink of an eye. Really, it's no choice at all. Don't ask me to abandon you because I won't. I'll do anything in my power to save you, as I'll do for you, Ya Amar. Nikki had to kiss him then, if only on the cheek. He had to take his hand and intertwine their fingers. If it comes down to you or them, to us or them, I'll do the right thing. You can trust me on that. Yusuf squeezed his hand. If he thinks about it, he can still feel his careful grip. So will I. I promise you. Nicolo wet his lips. If you have to. His mouth felt dry. His throat closed at the mere thought. Don't leave me here. Take me with you. He felt Yusuf stiffen, his breath catch in his throat. Nico, I'll just follow you. You know I will. Please, Yusuf. He could have said more, but he held his tongue. It had to be his decision and his alone. At last, he nodded. All right. If we have to go, we'll go together. Though hopefully none of this will ever come to pass, and this will remain a strictly hypothetical exercise. I hope so, too. He smiled then. I rather like the idea of growing old with you, you know. A couple of hours after sunset, his long wait is finally over. They kick in the door and come streaming in with their weapons drawn and ready. He counts six in the room, at least 10 in the church, and there must be another group covering the exits. They've got Heckler & Koch, G-36 and MP7, but he spots grenades and handguns too, plus all the extra magazines they could carry. Nicky watches them come from his seat at the table. His book, an incredibly lucky find at the airport, certainly not one of theirs or, God forbid, Booker's, open at the same page it has been all evening. He spent his last days working like a man possessed, and his last hours losing himself in his memories. But the book gave him something to do in between, even if it was reading the same poem again and again. He reads it one last time, ignoring the men surrounding him, their hateful stares lined over their sights. He doesn't do it twice. In the brief interval between two planes, he hears footsteps approaching. His eyes linger on the last two lines. I could not love thee, dear, so much. Loved I not honor more. Andy would roll her eyes at him. Quinn would smile indulgently and elbow her beloved wife in the ribs. Booker would laugh and call him and Joe a pair of incurable romantics. Perhaps they will someday if they decipher Joe's message in the last video. It might take a while. As they agreed years ago, he only sent the name and without vowels at that, but Booker might manage it. He's the one who knows them best. who shared so many books and stories with them. He looks up just as Joe steps through the door. Always a vision, a sight for sore eyes. Even angry, tense, and disheveled. His hands are tied in front of him with zip ties, but he's not gagged, just as Nikki demanded. Copley comes in right after him, a firm grip on his arm, and another of Merrick's lackeys behind them, his gun aimed straight at Joe's back. Nikki slowly stands and moves in front of the table, never taking his eyes off of him.
Joe. Nikki.
He's about 2 meters away when Copley stops, forcing Joe to do so as well.
Hello, Nikki. I'd say you haven't aged a day, but I'd be lying. That's Mr. Rossi to you and your associates, Mr. Copley.
Nikki doesn't even bother to look at him. There's only one man who matters here.
E bello vederti, amore. Mi sei mancato.
Joe's looking right back at him.
Anche tu, Nico. Tutto a posto.
Si. Joe smiles. It's not his usual grin, but it's there, and Nikki feels his heart soar. It's Yusuf and Niccolo to the end, as it was at the beginning and as it was meant to be.
Enough. Where are the others?
On their way. It's even true. All the safe houses he chose were at least 3 hours' drive from here, probably more since Niall will have to rely on the map. Copley's face contorts in anger.
That was not our deal.
Nikki shrugs.
Do you think I could take them on my own? There's what, 20 of you? And only 3 of them. What are you afraid of?
If the last thing he sees is Copley's face looking like that, he almost won't mind.
You worked with them. You know what they are. I know who they are. Do you?
Nikki glances back at Joe, finds his own irritation and amusement reflected in his eyes. Copley thinks he knows everything, but he hasn't got a clue about any of them. If he looked beyond their regular aging and normal healing rate, if he even bothered to investigate Niccolo Rossi and Joseph Jones at all, he went no further than Nicola Bacigalupo and Yusuf Samari. Booker's handiwork held true. He has no idea he's facing Niccolo de Genova and Yusuf ibn Ibrahim al-Khazani. Copley frowns.
I'm not here for a debate. Are you going back on our deal?
It doesn't have to go like this, Nikki says gently. Almost certainly in vain, but he has to try anyway.
You could let us go.
Leave. And Andy and the others will never need to know you were here. Copley stares at him in disbelief.
Leave? When we are so close?
He shakes his head as though he were talking to an ignorant child or a madman.
I don't understand you two at all. I mean, you knew. You must have known all these years. And you said nothing. You did nothing. It could mean the end of disease. Don't you realize it?
Joe huffs. Ibn Sina never met them. Neither did Edward Jenner, or Alexander Fleming, or... Copley tightens his grip on his arm. It must hurt, but Joe refuses to wince.
I'm not here for a history lesson either. Their immortality could be a gift to the world.
Nikki pities him, though not as much as he would have before he kidnapped Joe, before he tried to trap his family and cut them to pieces.
There's worse things than dying, Mr. Copley.
Joe nods tiredly. As I told you as well, repeatedly. Copley snarls.
Enough. Tell us where they are, or watch your lover die.
Joe snorts at being called his lover, a word he finds insufficient.
I assure you, Mr. Rossi, that would definitely make your list.
Nikki sighs. On your own head be it, then. He reaches for his phone, but the sound of several safeties being disengaged stops him.
If you want the rest of the team, you'll have to let me make this phone call.
Do I? Copley's voice is calm again, his expression smooth and courteous, no longer distorted by rage, bitterness, and greed.
Yes, Andy expects us to check in and let her know the safe house is still secure. We are almost overdue. How do I know you won't warn them?
Nikki looks around the room at the mercenaries surrounding them and their weapons at the ready.
As you said yourself, neither Joe nor I are immortal.
Copley smirks, sure of his victory. It's such a CIA smirk. Nikki wants to ask him if it's part of their training. Do they have to practice in front of a mirror?
Make the call, Mr. Rossi.
If he expects a thank you, he'll have to live with disappointment. Nikki grabs his phone from the table, unlocks it, and brings up his 4-people-long contact list, on which the second is Andy, in spite of the alphabet. His finger hovers over the familiar number. At the last second, he looks up, looks at Joe again.
Ti amo, Yusuf.
His eyes shine with unshed tears, but his voice does not waver.
Ti amo, anch'io.
He presses, call. Joe spins, throws Copley against the man holding him at gunpoint, and they rush towards each other. Before anybody else can move or react, the call connects, not to Andy's number, but to Joe's backup phone, currently acting as detonator for the explosives, TNT and C4, and even some gunpowder Nikki planted on the church columns and against the priory's load-bearing walls. Andy doesn't understand cell phones, probably never will, but she does appreciate explosives. Their safe houses are always well stocked. When he saw them coming in from the church, he feared they'd spot the wires and send his plan crashing down, though he needn't have worried. People always forget to look up. The entire building shakes. The roof crumbles in a hurricane of fire and stone. But Niccolo doesn't care because he has Yusuf in his arms again. Yusuf, who tries to shield him from the falling debris even now. Niccolo tries to turn his head. He wants to kiss him one last time. Wants that to be the very last thing he does. He doesn't make it. Chapter 4. Waiting is the worst part. It always is. Even 7 years in the Corps haven't dulled its edge. It's a long 3 months trying to strike the fine balance between staying off the grid and gathering intel on their enemy. There are many fights, starting from the moment Andy orders Booker to destroy his phone.
Do you want them to track us down? The boys can't call us anymore.
And returning every time they need to retreat away from civilization, and he has to stop working. Some days Niall wishes that Merrick's mercenaries would find them, so Andy, Quinn, and Booker could take their frustrations out on them rather than on each other. A couple of times the tension almost boils over, and for a split second she is sure they'll try and kill each other, but they never do. Perhaps they should. Perhaps they'd actually feel better if they let go and tore each other apart with their fists instead of their words. And isn't that a strange thought? But after hearing about Lycan, she understands why they won't risk it. For the next day or two, they are unbearably gentle, tiptoeing around each other until it devolves in another fight, conducted either in shouts and screams or in hissed whispers. It's exhausting. But it's also heartbreakingly familiar. It's a grieving family, and she remembers what hers was like. In a way, it's almost comforting, though she feels horrible for thinking it. And isn't that just the problem? Thinking. About her own family, her life that's over, completely over, and what it means for her that this Merrick knows about them, that the United States government knows about her and has her DNA, knows where her family lives. Best not to think about it too much. Find yourself a job, something to do, and do that. Make yourself useful. Make sure that Andy gets plenty of coffee, Quinn never runs out of cigarettes, and Booker remembers to eat. Slip back into the role of caretaker as though she never left it. It's even easier this time, since she doesn't have to deal with her own grief. They tell her it's her loss, too. That Nikki and Joe would have loved her. But she can't feel it. She barely met Nikki and Joe, not at all. And though she can feel their absence, the gaping wound that will not heal they left behind, she's still an outsider looking in. when she mourns, it's for her own family, for Mama and Dion, wondering what they've been told, if they've been told anything at all, still keeps her up at night. Nikki gave her back her phone, but his and Joe's fate have irrevocably brought home the bitter truth, more than Booker's own story ever could. She could never see her family again, or contact them in any way. Some days she tells herself it's only until Merrick is dealt with, but deep down she knows it's a lie. She can't imagine Mama or Dion turning against her but being used as hostages, dying because of her. That she can imagine only too well. She tries to keep her grief to herself, but the others still notice. In all fairness, they do try their best. Booker checks on her family from afar and only tells her what she wants to know. Are they safe? Yes. Good. Doesn't push more information on her or tell her she's doing the right thing. Andy drags her off for training, Quinn to get more clothes. Both of them patiently answer all her questions, or at least try. But when she first met Andy, she thought her cold and unfeeling. She wondered if immortality made her callous, so used to losing lesser mortals she no longer cared. She hadn't understood what she meant when she said that it still hurt. She still doesn't, not really, but she will someday, and that's a terrifying thought. How many times had they done this before? Gotten closer to somebody, a man, a woman, children, and watched them die. She wants to ask them how they do it, how they keep going. Most of all, where did they find the courage to keep Joe and Nikki, even knowing that someday they would lose them? They're not like this. And that's the crux of the matter, isn't it? Niall is young, but she has seen the difference between a peaceful goodbye at the end of a long, happy life and a life cut short before its time, like her father's. And even if she lives to 100,000 years, she still won't forgive Uncle Roger's wife for snidely telling her mother that it was just to be expected. And if she didn't want to be a young widow, she shouldn't have married a soldier. She watches the other three immortals grieve and rage and burn with the need for revenge, and wonders about the men who caused all this. The boys, as they still occasionally call them, the children they were. She has a million questions she wants to ask, but she cannot. Not about Joe and Nikki. Sometimes she looks at the three of them and wonders how on earth they don't resent her for being here when their boys are not. But they don't. If anything, they seem grateful for her presence. Andy and Quinn just stop sometimes in the middle of a word, of an action. They're suddenly silent and still, holding their breath. They turn to each other and exchange a look, and Niall knows then that something reminded them of Joe and Nikki. They always reach for each other, exchange quick, soft touches, a hand running down Andy's arm, a kiss to Quinn's forehead, and move on. Booker is the worst. He's either hunched over his laptop, working like a man possessed, or complaining he can't work more, because the hideout they are currently occupying is literally in the middle of nowhere. All the words he doesn't say by day come out at night. In his sleep, he shouts at Nikki, at Joe, at both of them, or cries and begs them not to die. Niall pretends she doesn't hear him. Her own dreams haunted by the smell of dust and explosives, by a dark, oppressive weight crushing all breath out of her. When she wakes up, gasping for air, she pretends it's because her own first death is still so close, so raw. It might even be true. They are all carrying enough guilt without having to worry about her nightmares, too. The only time they all genuinely smile is when Booker finds a recent picture of Merrick's chief of security, sporting a broken nose and a nice pair of black eyes. Joe's handiwork, they declare as one. The same pride in their voices she used to hear in her mother's when she or Dion brought home good grades. The worst day of all is in July. on what she eventually realizes must be Joe's birthday. Strange. She is the youngest, still within her natural lifespan, yet she lost track of time. Booker did not. Neither did Andy and Quinn. It's the one day they spend completely drunk. So much she thinks all of them die of alcohol poisoning at least once. That's not the worst part, though. The worst part is Booker stumbling towards the door, pleading with Andy to let him go.
The boys. I have to go get the boys.
He slurs over and over in several languages, and now wishes he hadn't remembered English, too.
They're alone down there. They're in the dark. They shouldn't be in the dark. They'll be scared. We have to get them, Andy. We can't leave them there.
I know, Booker, I know, Andy repeats gently, soothingly. We will go back for them, I promise you, Booker. Their bodies haven't been found yet. Booker can't go near the investigation or he'll go to pieces. Neither Andy nor Quinn know how, so Niall volunteered. One more job she can do. She honestly hadn't counted on the downsides, like Nikki and Joe invading her dreams, or her French improving enough she can understand Booker when he falls to his knees weeping.
They weren't supposed to go like that.
He chokes out.
Why do they go like that? Why? Why didn't they sell us out? They should have sold us out.
Andy kneels in front of him on the floor and pulls him into a hug, gently petting his hair.
Nikki was in love, not stupid. Joe would have done the same. I would have sold us out. For them, I would have.
Quinn stumbles towards them, each movement slow and exaggeratedly careful, so different from her usual grace. She lowers herself to the floor and wraps her arms around both, pressing her cheek against Booker's back.
You wouldn't have, Booker.
Unspoken, the harsh truth they all know, deep in their hearts, Merrick and Copley would have never risked leaving witnesses. Nikki and Joe were dead the moment Joe was snatched. No, earlier than that, the moment Copley found out about their immortality. Niall isn't sure what Nikki meant when he spoke of borrowed time, but he and Joe must have known, too. She puts her headphones on and loses herself in her music, giving them what little privacy she can. That night, she dreams about Nikki again. This time, he's on a train, asleep against Joe's shoulder as the rain beats against the window. She blames Harry Potter for this one, though the train doesn't look like the Hogwarts Express, and even if, contrary to all appearances, the dream didn't feel peaceful, she hopes it means her subconscious is finally putting them to rest. It doesn't. She gets 4 days of reprieve before she dreams of them again. It's a very long 3 months before they finally go after Merrick. Niall is not ready. 7 years in the Corps. 2 tours of duty, and she is not even remotely ready for Andromache the Scythian, Quinn of the Red River Valley, and Sebastian Le Livre, for the sheer hell they unleash on Merrick and his associates. They are a cataclysm made flesh, a firestorm of biblical proportions, 3 unstoppable avenging angels. Merrick's chief of security tries his best, but he's only human. In the end, he's even lucky. Niall is there to put a bullet in his head after Quinn guts him with the flick of her wrist. Merrick is not. They find him crouching inside the bathtub, and the first words out of his mouth are, "We can reach an agreement." Niall is standing at the back. She can't see Booker's face, but she hears him snarl.
"Agreement? You killed my sons."
She barely gets out of the doorway in time. Before Merrick crashes through it and on the floor, she hears a couple of bones snap. Before he can move, Andromache, Quinn, and Booker surround him, looming over him, a pack of wolves around a lapdog who thought himself one of them. She hears his whimpers, his pleas that turn into screams of agony when Andromache shoots out his kneecaps and Quinn presses a small Beretta to his stomach and pulls the trigger. For a moment, she debates simply shooting him, just like she did with Keen. but there's a soft voice whispering in her head, wondering what he would have done if Copley had moved later, if he had had time to learn about her existence too. It would have been so much easier to snatch a nurse and a college student rather than two trained mercenaries with years of experience.
"Thank you for your cooperation, Mr. Merrick," Andromache says. "It was very convenient for you to live above one of your labs."
Quinn nods. "Very interesting places, laboratories, I've always found, full of nice, flammable things."
Merrick stares at them uncomprehendingly, stupid with pain and shock. Then Booker starts pouring out the contents of the bottles he's been carrying around for several floors now, and Merrick starts screaming again.
Niall's stomach turns, not just because of the chemical smell. She should stop this. She really should.
Quinn grabs her by the arm and guides her to the door.
"He's all yours, Booker," she says over her shoulder.
"Don't linger this time," Andromache adds, as she takes Niall's other arm and keeps walking.
"Once they're out of the penthouse," Niall shakes them off. "I'm not the old woman here."
She keeps walking and doesn't look back, not a single time.
"Come on. It's a long way down."
"There's the elevator."
"You can't use that during a fire, Quinn."
"We could," Andy begins, eyeing the windows.
Niall glares at her, trying to channel all her drill sergeants at once.
"Don't even think about it. You wanted a fire, you get the stairs. Come on."
They get out with time to spare, though they end up waiting for Booker in the car as clouds of black smoke surround the building and wailing sirens approach.
Niall leans forward between the front seats.
"Do you think he got trapped?"
Andy taps her fingers against the steering wheel. Quinn reaches out and covers her hand with her own.
"Give him time. He'll want to make sure."
Niall is so busy watching the building, she almost jumps out of her skin when the car door opens and Booker slides into the seat next to hers, hair a little singed, and clothes smelling of smoke and chemicals.
"Done."
Andromache shakes her head as she starts the car.
"We're not done yet."
Niall collapses back against her seat. Booker grins. "Well," bares his teeth.
"The rest of Keene's team?"
It makes sense. They wouldn't all be on shift together now, but Andy shakes her head again.
"We'll get to them later. Copley had a house in Surrey. We'd better check it out and get whatever he had on us before his body is identified and his old colleagues come get his things."
"Merrick didn't get there first?" Niall asks.
Quinn turns in her seat.
"No, he didn't really need to. He was very careful in his communications with Copley. If Joe hadn't told us..."
She trails off, her grief rising to the surface again. Andy's left hand leaves the steering wheel and lands on her knee, squeezing gently.
"We would have found him anyway, my heart."
A smile that's more a flash of teeth.
"It would have taken just a bit longer, but we would have found him."
Quinn nods, a shark-like smirk on her lips.
"Right. Anyway, the church spooked him badly. He stayed well away, hoping we wouldn't find out he financed the whole operation."
Niall nods.
"Makes sense. So, Copley's house, is it far?"
"As it turns out, it's not. A little over 1 hour, and they're there, even after stopping and switching the Vauxhall Astra for a Volkswagen Golf right outside of London. Copley's house is fairly isolated, a modern building that's all straight lines and big glass walls, though right now all the curtains are drawn and the roller blinds are down. It's a beautiful summer day, sunny and warm, with hardly a cloud in the sky, yet the house already has that indefinable air of abandonment all houses get when they're left empty for a while." They still approach cautiously, taking their time to inspect the grounds for watchers. This time there's nothing, not even cameras, unsurprisingly. Of course, a former spy would value his privacy and guard it closely. Niall privately reflects that it says a lot about human nature as Booker picks the lock with a frown.
"I think somebody's already been here."
Andy and Quinn exchange a glance, then reach for their weapons.
"You two take the first floor. We'll search the ground floor."
Both Niall and Booker do the same and go up the stairs.
There's a faint light up ahead. Then something moves. A human-shaped shadow. Niall barely has time to see it when Booker fires twice. It all happens at once. The figure goes down with a pained cry. Booker freezes mid-step, mutters a curse in French, then runs ahead, jumping over the last steps and ignoring Andy and Quinn's shouted questions from below. She follows, trying to cover him.
Booker, wait!
The lights, Niall. Find the lights.
He beats her to it, though. When the lights switch on, he looks down at the wounded man, and all blood drains from his face. Niall can't blame him. She's pretty sure hers is doing the same.
Andy, call an ambulance, he shouts,
throwing himself down on his knees again, his gun abandoned as he tries to put pressure on the chest wound he just caused.
What? Are you...
Andy, I shot Joe.
Hurried footsteps up the stairs and from the back of the house. Niall turns toward the noise and finds herself staring straight at Nikki over the barrel of her Sig Sauer. He has a gun too, but he's keeping the muzzle down towards the ground, his eyes fixed on Joe, because the man on the floor, the man Booker shot, is Joe. She saw him in the videos Copley sent Nikki, and she thought her subconscious had done a remarkable job bringing him to life in her dreams, but it wasn't that. It's him. It has always been him, which must mean... She glances at Nikki again. If she knows one thing, is what he looks like when he's worried, when he's deathly afraid, and right now he is neither. His whole posture is relaxed, at ease. There's even a faint smile on his lips. Andy and Quinn stare at him, at Joe, who keeps trying to push away Booker's hands and interrupt his litany of apologies in at least three different languages.
Booker, he says again, casting a pleading glance at the others.
Nikki's smile widens. Andy lowers her axe, her eyes shining with unshed tears. Quinn covers her mouth with her hands, a soft giggle escaping as she leans against Andy.
Papa!
Booker freezes again, finally looking up at Joe, who is grinning as he grabs his hands and moves them off his chest.
I'm fine. Look.
He pulls up his shirt all the way to his neck. His skin is unbroken without a single mark.
See? I'm fine.
Booker stares. He looks down at Joe, then up at Nikki, then down again.
To it. You healed.
Joe pulls his shirt down and sits up.
Yes. You are like us.
Yes. He looks up at Nikki again, fear and hope warring in his eyes.
You too?
Nikki nods.
We came back together. Three at once, almost.
Quinn whispers to herself.
That's never happened, ever.
Andy is almost 7,000 years old, yet she sounds like she's witnessing a miracle. Nikki tucks his gun into the back of his pants, smiling.
I told you it was destiny.
He looks back at Booker, his smile fading.
We know we're not really. After what happened to your family?
We can leave if it bothers you, Joe finishes for him. You never have to see us again. Nikki nods.
We never want to hurt you, any of you.
Andy frowns. Quinn takes a deep breath, the kind that clearly precede a thorough yelling at. But Booker this time is faster.
Taisez-vous, he growls, pulling Joe up into a hug. Non dite che sate.
Niall isn't sure what he said, but she can guess from the way Joe hugs him back, clinging to his shoulders.
Come here, you.
Nikki doesn't need to be told twice, wrapping his arms around Booker and Joe. Quinn laughs, loud and happy, and pushes Andy down towards them before turning, quick as a viper, grabbing Niall's wrist and pulling her down into the group hug with her. The original plan. Search Copley's house from top to bottom, no matter how long it takes, destroy all evidence, check that he didn't have more hideouts, is scrapped as Nikki and Joe not only dismantled Copley's original stalker wall, but made another one pointing in an entirely different direction. They have also expanded Copley's research to include several other avenues, faith healers, healing crystals, the fountain of youth, even scribbles about his wife being poisoned by some mysterious enemy. Russia, or maybe somebody in the CIA itself. Whoever is sent to investigate will have no trouble dismissing all talk of immortal warriors as just another legend on which his deluded mind latched. It doesn't matter to whom he talked or what he said. His reputation now will be thoroughly trashed. Niall feels a shiver run down her spine. Nikki and Joe, who the others unfailingly described as kind and sweet, have murdered a man twice over. Part of her is unsettled by their ruthlessness, the cold-blooded thoroughness of it all. Part of her appreciates it, recognizing the need to protect themselves and their family. Protect her, too. Andy orders one last sweep of the house, and then they return to London. You boys got your own car, right? Yes, we got the Fiesta from Sarah, Joe says. Have you got the keys? Booker asks. Sure, they're right here. Hey! As soon as Joe holds them up, Booker reaches out and snatches them from his hand. Great, I'm driving. Nikki looks like he's about to protest, but Joe minutely shakes his head, glancing towards Booker with eyes full of sadness and understanding. They return to the tiny apartment in the East End they had been using as base, and the three of them arrive first, even with a slight detour to grab dinner from a hole-in-the-wall Indian takeaway. Quinn frowns, glancing down at her watch. Andy shakes her head, a small tremulous smile. Booker's driving. They'll be here soon. Quinn nods. Right. She smiles back, small and a bit incredulous still. I can't believe it's real that they're... Andy takes her hand, squeezing it tightly. And Niall turns away to grab the rest of their dinner out of the car, carefully piling boxes and bags in her arms. True to her words, the other three immortals arrive some 10 minutes after them, before the shall we put dinner in the fridge or wait debate really gains steam. Niall sits it out, waiting to see how long it will take the oldest women in the world to remember that cell phones exist, and turns around as soon as she hears the door open. The three men spill inside, looking tired and suspiciously bright-eyed. Nikki's and Joe's dart left and right, clearly taking in the green walls, shag carpet and brown velvet couch, and trying not to show it. Niall only does because she was watching for their reaction, waiting to see whether it confirms something she has suspected since the moment she first set foot into the kitchen living room, kitchen on one wall, couch against the other, that they have never been here before. And if that wasn't the only reason Andy and Quinn chose this place, it certainly played a big part. The apartment is a tight fit for four people. Adding two more sends it from crowded to sardine can, but none of the others seem to mind, even if Nikki and Joe have to eat on the couch. It has been a long day, and the food smells heavenly, and they all tuck in with a vengeance, though it's not quite a nice family dinner. There's still a tension in the air between Booker and Joe and Nikki in the main, but Andy and Quinn are part of it too. Niall is beginning to understand why Quinn insists they get ice cream too. This will clearly be the kind of conversation that requires tons of it. Over the scraping of spoons against the plastic tubs, Andy takes the lead, her voice gentle and soft. Why didn't you tell us, Nikki? We could have helped you. Joe bristles and opens his mouth to speak, ready to defend him, but Nikki grabs his hand and shakes his head before turning back to them. I didn't have time. When Copley first contacted me, you had all already left and gone off the grid. I wasn't even sure you'd be back in time. But we were, Quinn insists, at the church. When you showed us the video, we could have helped you. Nikki shakes his head again. Copley's deadline would pass before we could figure out where he had Joe. Besides, I was afraid he planned for that too and would be waiting for you. Nikki's right. You wouldn't have found me. They moved me around all the time, even on Merrick's private plane, Joe interjects. They stayed in the air as long as they could. Booker slams his bowl of half-melted and mostly uneaten ice cream on the table. So killing yourselves was better? Nikki lowers his eyes, unable to look at them, and sits back against the couch. He even tries to let go of Joe's hand, but Joe is having none of it, holding on tightly. It was our decision. You said, before that, we could choose.
I didn't actually mean you to do it, Booker shouts. You weren't supposed to do it.
Joe's voice is deceptively calm, the kind of tone that sounds innocuous but burns like acid.
So you lied to us. We had no choice at all.
Booker jumps to his feet, his chair screeching against the floor.
You weren't supposed to die for us.
So what were we supposed to do, sell you out? Copley and Merrick would have killed us anyway, and you know it. Anyway, it all worked out in the end, didn't it?
That's not the point.
Nikki looks up, deliberately meeting Booker's gaze and holding it.
We couldn't have lived without ourselves if we had been the cause of your capture, no matter how it happened.
Joe leans forward, still holding Nikki's hand.
It was our call, our choice. We didn't regret it then. We can't regret it now, just because we're alive to do it.
Booker clearly wants to say more, but Quinn calls his name and lays a placating hand on his arm. He looks away, muttering something in Vietnamese, and sits down, though Niall has a feeling the argument is far from over and will be revisited in the future, probably for the next millennium. Quinn pats his arm one more time, then turns back to Joe and Nikki, a knowing look in her eyes.
Well, we're glad you're with us. We can still regret your first death wasn't quicker and less painful.
Joe and Nikki freeze. Their shoulders and backs go stiff, their knuckles turn white. They even stop breathing for a second, just like Andy and Quinn. Up to now, Niall couldn't really imagine Andy, Quinn, and Booker raising children, raising the two men that sit next to her, but now she can see it all too clearly. Andy leans forward.
Boys, please. If you don't want to talk about it, we'll understand. But don't hold back on our account. We'd rather know.
The seconds tick by, then Nikki draws a shaky breath.
It was hard. It took us a while to come back and to get out.
Quinn tries to suppress a shudder. Booker rubs his eyes, swearing under his breath. Niall reaches for a glass of water, suddenly tasting dust again. Joe pulls Nikki closer, wrapping an arm around his shoulders.
We made it out before they realized we were there at all. We were unbelievably lucky.
Niall doesn't think simple luck is going to cut it, but for the moment doesn't comment.
And then, Quinn asks, we tried a couple of the French safe houses and the one in Belgium, but it was taking too long, Joe replies.
We still remembered where Copley lived, so we decided to check what he had on you and wait there.
You really must let us show you, Nikki says,
some color returning to his face.
It's amazing.
Maybe one day. I'm just glad you didn't go after Merrick yourselves. Andy's spoon stops halfway to her mouth. Her eyes narrow as Nikki and Joe exchange a guilty glance.
Wait. Don't tell me you were thinking of...
We considered it, Nikki admits. But it wasn't practical with just the two of us.
Joe shrugs.
We tried to keep an eye on Merrick's building for a while, but we were almost spotted. The operatives they sent had cameras. They knew we were supposed to be dead.
What I want to know, Booker says, grabbing back his ice cream, is why the hell you didn't call us. You always insist that we keep our phones with us.
We tried.
Joe protests, raising a hand not currently rubbing Nikki's shoulder in surrender.
By the time we got a phone, you had already ditched your old numbers and Andy's voicemail was full as usual.
So is yours, Booker.
Nikki adds, crossing his arms over his chest.
We left you a ton of messages.
Booker turns bright red and glares at Andy.
I told you you should have let me check it.
What? You did not. Don't try and blame it on me.
Wait. What about the dreams?
Quinn interrupts them. Niall wonders if it's too late to hide in the bathroom. Andy frowns.
I didn't dream of them, did you?
Quinn shakes her head.
No, but Niall and Joe only met today. Didn't you dream of each other?
Joe nods.
I did, but I never got enough to figure out where you were. You were moving around too much.
Niall fidgets with her spoon.
I dreamt of you too, she admits quietly. But I always saw Nikki. I thought I was dreaming him.
She expects the others to be angry, not to exchange fond, exasperated looks.
Of course you'd see Nikki.
Only to be expected with these two, Quinn nods. You'd better get used to it.
I'm sorry I didn't realize. Jo waves away her apologies. Think nothing of it, Niall, really.
Nikki turns to her, bows their heads, close together.
I'm sorry you had to dream of us when we were trapped, he whispers.
It wasn't that bad.
Not as bad as living it must have been.
Please, don't apologize.
He nods solemnly.
Okay, as long as you do the same.
Anyway, no harm done, Jo shrugs, serving himself more ice cream, then pushing the tub towards her. If you hadn't come to Copley's, we were planning to follow Quinn's example and leave messages in all the safe houses we know. You would have found one sooner or later.
It's not like time is an issue anymore, Nikki agrees, turning back to the table with an impish grin.
Andy throws a piece of bread at him. Niall leans back in her chair and watches them banter, laugh, and tease each other. It's like seeing them for the first time. For all the chaos, she feels an overwhelming sense of belonging, a rightness. All is well. All is as it should be. And she is not an outsider looking in. She's part of it. One of them. There's still the matter of her own family to consider. Merrick and Copley may be gone, but the U.S. government is most definitely not. Though right now, the idea of spending centuries, millennia even, with these men and these women doesn't seem so bad. Right now, she feels like a great weight has fallen from her shoulders. The boulder pressing down in the middle of her chest has crumbled into dust, and she can breathe again. She feels safe. The end.